You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Omar Khadr was captured in July 2002 by the U.S. military in a village in Afghanistan. He was 15 years old at the time. A few days ago, Omar Khadr spent his 26th birthday behind bars in Guantanamo Bay, and the breaking news today is that he was just repatriated to Canada and is now in a maximum security prison. In 2010, Omar Khadr signed a pre-trial agreement pleading guilty to 5 charges of war crimes and terrorism. As part of the agreement, he accepted an 8-year sentence, not including time served, with the possibility of a transfer to Canada after at least 1 year to serve the remainder of the sentence here. Despite this, he had not been allowed to return to Canada until today. Omar Khadr, O Canada, is the title of a new anthology edited by Janice Williamson from the Department of English and Film Studies at the University of Alberta. Janice Williamson and several of the contributors to the book spoke at the Vancouver launch. We're going to hear some of their comments this morning. Gail Davidson has been a tireless advocate for Omar Khadr. She is Executive Director of Lawyers' Rights Watch Canada. Here is Gail Davidson, recorded at the Vancouver Public Library on September 19th.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for being here. There's an awful lot that I could say about Omar Khadr, so I'm going to say some things very, very quickly. First of all, Omar Khadr has never been convicted of a legitimate offense. He's never even had the opportunity of being brought before a properly constituted court to determine his rights or any charges against him. He's been tortured for over 10 years, first in Bagram, then in Guantanamo Bay Prison. The Canadian government has been complicit in the violation of virtually all of his rights protected by international law and Canadian law, including rights to liberty, habeas corpus, to be properly informed of charges, to be represented by and have privileged communications with legal counsel, to have charges and rights determined by an independent and impartial tribunal, to equality before the law and to the equal protection of the law, to a trial within a reasonable time, to freedom from torture, from arbitrary arrest and detention, freedom from prosecution for ex post facto or otherwise illegitimate offenses, and lastly, the right of access to necessaries, proper food, education, privacy, control over one's immediate environment and living space, access to the company of other human beings, contact with friends and family. No court in the U.S. or Canada has found Khadr's treatment at Bagram or Guantanamo Bay Prison to be legal or otherwise justifiable. Canadian courts, the Supreme Court, the Federal Court, and the Federal Court of Appeal have all ruled that the treatment of Omar Khadr in Guantanamo Bay violates the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the UN Convention Against Torture, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and the Geneva Conventions. In 2008, the Canadian Parliamentary Committee struck to consider the Omar Khadr case after hearing over 70 witnesses recommended, and I quote here, that the Government of Canada demand Khadr's release from U.S. custody at Guantanamo Bay to the custody of Canadian law enforcement officials as soon as practical. Close quote. On June 9th, the Canadian Senate adopted this resolution by a majority vote. On March 29th, 2008, the House, Canadian House of Commons did the same thing. In 2009, the Federal Court and the Federal Court of Appeal ordered Prime Minister Stephen Harper, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the commissioners of both the RCMP and CSIS to address these grave violations by promptly requesting Omar Khadr's release from U.S. custody and his repatriation to Canada. The Harper executive again refused. In May 2012, the UN Committee Against Torture, in response to a report filed jointly by two organizations, Lawyers' Rights Watch Canada and the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group, determined that Canada's treatment of Omar Canada did violate Canada's obligations under the Convention Against Torture and asked Canada, recommended to Canada, quote, to promptly approve Omar Khadr's transfer application and ensure that he receives appropriate redress for human rights violations that the Canadian Supreme Court has ruled he experienced. Close quote. Now, backing up a little bit, on October the 13th of 2010, Omar Khadr agreed to plead guilty to the trumped-up charges in return for an agreement by the U.S. to limit his period of additional incarceration to 8 years, and the further agreement to allow Khadr to be repatriated back to Canada after serving one of those 8 years. Now, at that time, then Foreign Minister Lawrence Cannon said, and I quote, "We will implement the agreement that was reached between Mr. Cotter and the government of the United States," close quote. Cotter's lawyers say that Canada's agreement, that agreement as expressed by Foreign Minister Cannon, would not have pled guilty without that agreement. Now, on April 12, 2012, the U.S. approved Cotter's transfer to Canada, and Canada is still refusing to allow or to approve his transfer. While the current Minister of Public Safety, Vic Taves, agrees that Mr. Cotter is entitled to come back to Canada eventually, by virtue of the fact that he's a Canadian citizen, Mr. Taves says, quote, "The issue of when does he come back to Canada, that's a determination I have to make, and I haven't made any decision in that respect yet," close quote. Mr. Taves claims to be considering whether or not he will use his newly acquired discretion under the International Transfer of Offenders Act to refuse Cotter's repatriation to Canada. Now, if I can just give you some background information, Canada is a signatory to 13 bilateral treaties and 3 multilateral conventions on the transfer of offenders that have been convicted and sentenced overseas, and those agreements include the cooperation of over 60 nations. Between 1978 and 2009, over 1,500 Canadians were transferred back to Canada to serve their prison sentences in accordance with the purpose of that Transfer Act, that purpose being to promote justice and the rehabilitation and reintegration of Canadian offenders convicted abroad back into Canadian society. Transfer requests had been regularly accepted and permitted until 2006, when the Harper government started refusing to allow the transfer of a significant number of offenders. And since the plea agreement was entered into in October of 2010, the Harper's government, the Conservatives actually, all by themselves, because the Liberals and the NDP and the Bloc Québécois did not agree, have forced the amendment of the Transfer Act. Part of the hotly contested omnibus bill C-38 was bill C-5 to amend the International Transfer of Offenders Act to allow Minister Taves and his successors as public safety ministers to arbitrarily refuse the transfer of prisoners under the newly introduced rubric to that particular act of public safety. The amendments to the Transfer Act essentially allow, in the Cotter case, the use of the law to break the law. Cotter's Canadian lawyers have, of course, now filed yet another. All the lawyers in Canada that have been acting Mr. Cotter all these years have all been acting free. So Cotter's been denied, both by the Canadian government and the U.S. government, his internationally protected right to legal aid when having a lawyer is absolutely necessary. In any event, they filed an application in federal court asking for an order compelling Minister Taves to approve Cotter's transfer to Canada. They're pleading to the court, says a number of shocking things, things that I hope shock us. They say the minister has breached the principles of natural justice and deprived the applicant of procedural fairness. The minister's delay in rendering a decision is, they say, an abuse of process. In April 2002, the CBC conducted an online poll. The CBC is one of those media outlets that continues every time they mention Mr. Cotter to refer to him as a person convicted of murder, as a convicted war criminal, which is wrong, of course. They know all that. Anyway, they ran an online poll in April of 2001 with the question, quote, "Should Omar Cotter be allowed to return to Canada?" Keeping mum, of course, of all the court orders, the experts, the decisions of the whole government of Canada, the Parliament and the Senate, and a whopping 43% of the people answered the poll by saying no. And so I'm very happy to have you here tonight, because now it's up to me and up to you to ensure that Omar Cotter's return to Canada just as justice and decency allow. Please write to Minister Taves, write to your Member of Parliament, speak to your neighbours. On the table over there, there's a bunch of copies of articles and reports that have been prepared by Lawyers Rights Watch and Lawyers Against the War over the years, and a sign-up sheet if you want copies of all or any of that material or want to be involved in any new initiatives to try and have Mr. Cotter repatriated to Canada. Thank you very much.
We've been listening to Gail Davidson speaking at the Vancouver launch of the new anthology called Omar Khadr, O Canada, edited by Janice Williamson. That was recorded on September 19th, and the breaking news today is that Omar Khadr arrived in Toronto at 7:45 a.m. and is being transferred to Millhaven Maximum Security Prison in Ontario. The next speaker we'll hear is Grace Wu. She is a lawyer and legal scholar who has studied the legal efforts to bring Omar Khadr to Canada to serve out the rest of his sentence. She speaks here about the actions of the Supreme Court of Canada in overturning a lower court ruling ordering the Canadian government to bring Omar Khadr back to this country.
When I started studying international law, I didn't expect that Canada would become a major violator of human rights. I thought we were international leaders, an example to others. We were known for having a culture of peace and respect. Now we're known for supporting torture, for violation of children's rights, and what we're experiencing now is a total disregard for the rule of law. The rule of law means that the rules that our society has decided upon are going to be applied equally to everyone. Several people have mentioned this phenomenon where Omar is being called a convicted terrorist. They seem to be able to do this with impunity. This is defamation. Omar has never been convicted by a legally constituted court. His so-called confession wouldn't stand up in any properly constituted court. There are many irregularities in this confession, many really weird things. For example, why did they want Omar to sign a statement saying that he voluntarily relinquishes his right for any forensic or scientific testing of any physical evidence, including but not limited to DNA evidence? Why are they so... If Omar was being held for valid reasons, why should they be concerned with suppressing evidence? I don't think Omar will go for defamation. I think he's sick and tired of being caught up in legal procedures. It's been most of his life. I think he could be forgiven if he wants to maybe study literature, study other people, and leave his own problems behind. And I am not as concerned for Omar as I am for the rest of us, that somehow we've gotten on with our lives and we've allowed this to happen. What my article about was about what happened at the Supreme Court of Canada. And we have a very, very serious problem there. How did we lose the protection of the Supreme Court of Canada? Now, I wrote that paper because most people don't have the education needed to read Supreme Court cases, or it's not easy for them. Most lawyers in Canada don't have time. They also don't have education in international human rights law. This is an area of interest that is treated as a sideline, and that might be one of the reasons why there hasn't been a larger upswelling of lawyers. I mean, what happened to Omar is so shocking. You would think that everyone in the legal profession and all educated citizens would just be shocked. When I look at the court system, I have to ask, what went wrong? The federal court and the Federal Court of Appeal both gave impeccably written reasons. All the Supreme Court of Canada had to do was refuse leave to appeal to those cases. Why it didn't, I don't know, because they refused leave to appeal to the majority of cases that people bring to the court. They should have left well enough alone. They were good decisions. Instead, what the Supreme Court of Canada chose to do was to undermine the very foundations of democracy and the rule of law. And that's what I find most disturbing. Apparently, it did this at the behest of our Department of Justice. And this raises a number of questions about how the Department of Justice functions. Why was there public money? Why is the Department of Justice being used to come up with arguments that go against the will of Parliament, that go against conventions that have been signed by Canada and by the majority of nations internationally, so that it has become imperative law that everyone must follow? Why would our Department of Justice be working on such a thing? Why would they make arguments that violate the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, Canadian law, and international human rights? Why would they be working on that? That I don't understand. I've never worked there. I don't understand what goes on behind the scenes, and I don't understand what happened at the Supreme Court of Canada, because the Supreme Court of Canada is full of people that are very competent. They've written many competent decisions on the kinds of issues that came up in Omer Khadr's case, but the reasoning at the Supreme Court level contradicted some of their prior reasoning in some cases such as Hape and Suresh. I won't go into the details of those here. People try to get what they can out of the Supreme Court case, and the Supreme Court did recognize that the frequent flyer program was improper. They didn't use the word torture, but it was improper, and people tried to emphasize that when they look at the Supreme Court decision. But what is really shocking and horrible is that the Supreme Court granted the executive in Canada unprecedented discretionary powers over foreign affairs. They did this using a number of strange little subterfuges. One of the main ones that they used was that they cited a case called Reference as to the Effect of the Exercise of the Royal Prerogative of Mercy on Deportation Proceedings. This was an old case from 1933. And that case cited Dicey, who was considered an expert on the English Constitution, as saying that prerogative power was, quote, the residue of discretionary or arbitrary authority which at any time is legally left in the hands of the Crown. Now, what's wrong with the Supreme Court of Canada citing this precedent when it didn't follow some of its own precedents that were more recent and quite correctly discussed the impact of international law? Well, to begin with, in 1933, Canada was not the independent state that it is today. Despite the Balfour Declaration in 1926 that said that Canada and the Dominions were equal to Britain within the British Empire, Canada was still legally a colony. There were still appeals of court cases to the Privy Council. There was no Canadian citizenship until 1947. There was no United Nations. There was no Charter of Rights and Freedoms. There was no Convention on the Rights of the Child or Convention Against Torture. It's only since World War II that equality rights have become very big and important. So one thing the court did is it didn't take into account the changes in Canada as a constitutional entity or as a state, that Canada is now a full-fledged state, and even the concept of statehood has changed enormously since 1933, and certainly a lot more since 100 years ago. It didn't take any of that into account. But what's also wrong is their use of this quote from Dicey that was used in a completely different context. Now we're in the age of the internet. I was able to just look on the internet, and in no time flat, I found the entire text of Dicey's book. And just by doing a search and putting in a few pertinent phrases, I was able to come up with Dicey's opinion on prerogative power. And there are many quotes that suggest that Dicey would not have approved of this Supreme Court decision were he still alive. For example, Dicey pointed out that there is always a danger lest the use of the prerogative should supersede the supremacy of law. One of the important things about our British heritage, there have been a lot of unfortunate things. I've written a whole book about what was wrong, what went wrong with the British colonization of indigenous peoples. However, there were some good things about the British Empire which may explain some of its success. And one of the good things was that according to the British legal system, the monarch is always subject to the laws of the land. Who makes the laws of the land? It's the people. And we have now an administration that thinks that the law is what they think it should be. They have left aside both the Conservatives and the Liberals in their treating of Omer Khadr have moved away from the kind of principles that were very important when people were pushing for the expansion of democracy. And they've decided that I'm the king of the castle and you're the dirty rascal. That was never the theory of British monarchy, except perhaps for a time under some of the Stuarts, and they were put out of power. So I think what we have to learn from Omer's situation, it's not just to get justice for Omer Khadr, but it's to make sure that there are no more Omer Khadrs. What we're up against is very difficult. I think people tried just about everything they can think of. And really, in the end, whether we have a democracy has to do with individual decisions to follow the rule of law and to follow that. There cannot be a kind of society where our rights are discretionary, even though it's a law. You know, I like the color of your coat, so you can have what you want, but I don't like the way you're dressed. I don't think you should have the benefit of the law. I don't like your beard. You know, what is this? And why should Omar have to suffer this derogation of the principle of the rule of law? Thank you.
We've been listening to Grace Wu, lawyer and legal scholar, recorded at the Vancouver Public Library on September 19th. She is one of the contributors to the book Omer Khadr, O Canada. It's a new anthology edited by Janice Williamson. You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. The final speaker we're going to hear from today is Robert Diab. He is a lawyer and author of Guantanamo North, Terrorism and the Administration of Justice in Canada. He co-authored his contribution to the anthology with Eleanor Gova. Here is Robert Diab.
I'll just begin by conveying that Eleanor and I, in our contribution to this collection, decided that we would approach the Omer Khadr story by looking at a larger pattern that we think it belongs to. So we looked at a series of cases, and Merarar's case is one of them, and I'll tell you a bit about the others. But we think that it ought to be seen as part of a pattern of government conduct or response to certain cases, and that it ought to be contrasted with the approach in a couple of other cases that I'll mention, and we reflect on this difference. So over the course of this decade, as some of you may know, a number of Muslim or Arab Canadians found themselves in trouble abroad or were, in a sense, the victims of Canada's own mistreatment of them abroad. So you know the Khadr story. You've heard the Arar story this evening. Another well-known story, and I won't be too detailed about these stories, is the story of Aboufsian Abdul Razak, who is a Sudanese Canadian who traveled back to Sudan to see his ailing mother. and it's a very complex story, but due in large part to information provided to the Sudanese government by CSIS, by Canada. He was detained, held at length, tortured, then eventually released, and then more information was provided, and he went through, in essence, the whole thing all over again. He was at one point interrogated by CSIS agents in Sudan, which is really extraordinary. When he was eventually released, by the time he was released, because he was in Sudan much longer than he had planned to be, his passport had expired, and Canada wouldn't give him another passport. And what was really peculiar about this is that it resisted doing so, even though the RCMP and CSIS by then had cleared him of any suspicion of wrongdoing. So he was. This is the story where the person was stuck in the embassy in Khartoum. So there's that story. There was also the three subjects of the Yakubuchi inquiry, if anyone remembers those. Those were three Arab Canadians traveling in Syria and Egypt, suffered detention and torture. There was an inquiry. The inquiry found that Canada was at least complicit in their torture, not directly responsible for it, but provided information that played a role. And lastly, there's the case of Suad Muhammad, who's the woman in Kenya who was the subject of a kind of mistaken identity issue. They suspected her of having forged her own identity papers. They didn't detain her, but they placed her on bail, and they were sort of slow in helping her out and so forth. Anyhow, the point that we make is that if you look at these cases, what you see is Canada resisting assisting these Canadians abroad or actively making the situation much worse. And at the end, when everything is said and done, Canada resists accountability altogether, with the exception of the Arar case, which is quite exceptional in a number of ways. We speculate that in that case, maybe Arar was compensated because the case and the evidence there was so strong and so forth. But nevertheless, the pattern is a reluctance to take accountability. On the other hand, at the same time, there were a couple of cases involving Canadians who were not Arab or Muslim, like, for example, Brenda Martin, who was a Canadian who traveled to Mexico and was kind of caught up in a Ponzi scheme and charged and convicted in Mexico of money laundering, I think, was the offense. She was in custody there from 06 to 08, and during that period, Paul Martin, no relation, like the former prime minister, went to see her. Jason Kenney went to see her. And then ultimately, Harper himself personally intervened with the Mexican president. And a few weeks later, she was brought home. And 9 days later, she was released. And she was found guilty. I mean, she was, you know, okay. And then just one more case that we compare it to is the case of the, Robert Fowler, who was kidnapped in 2008 at a Canadian mine. Fowler was some kind of envoy, so he did have a quasi-governmental position. But foreign affairs worked tirelessly. One official we cite describes there being a kind of 24/7 rescue operation set up just to bring him back and one other aide to him. And so you have this kind of contrast. Now, there are counterexamples that it's important to point out. In 2006, Canada did quite a bit to bring back, in a hurry, all the Lebanese Canadians who were traveling in Lebanon in the summer that the war broke out between Israel and Hezbollah. And so so that's an important counterexample. There are a few other instances where Canada has assisted people in the Arab world who are suffering persecution in this way or, you know, in certain ways, so that we concede that there are those counterexamples. But nevertheless, we are left with this odd pattern. And so we posit, we suggest three possible readings, and I'll be very brief here. One reading is the good faith reading. You might say that in each of these cases I'm describing where Canada either didn't help or hindered the situation, there was good reason. I mean, there's an argument to be made in each of these cases for why Canada got involved and did what it did. And it's unfortunate that it hasn't come around and offered more compensation and support or accountability. There's the national security reading, we suggest, that in the climate of fear following 9/11, we were just more paranoid, and that maybe our paranoia, the government that is, has in large part to do with the fact that they have information that the rest of us don't. They're acting on secret information that makes, you know, the situation seem more critical than we can appreciate and so forth. And then we end with the skeptical reading, which suggests that maybe it was the case for both the liberal and the conservative governments that it was obvious that in the wake of 9/11, there was a great deal of there was not a lot of sympathy, or you could say there was a great deal of animosity toward Arab and Muslim Canadians. And there was nothing to be gained politically to support these groups. And so there was an obvious reason to be silent about Khadr, about Abdul Razak, or to be indifferent to them, rather. So we have these three possibilities, and we end by suggesting that the point isn't which one of them is right. The point is that there's a lingering ambiguity about it. And we say that ambiguity does enormous violence to the idea of citizenship in Canada. That if you, whether you are a member of these minorities or are not, all Canadians are left with a sense that maybe Canadian citizenship isn't universal. Maybe some groups are not fully Canadian. And that in turn does violence to our sense of Canada as an exemplary pluralistic society, a multicultural society, an example for the world at a time when many countries in the world are struggling with how to assimilate their minorities and so forth. So it is a complicated issue, but once again, I'm encouraged by how many people I see come out to talks like this, how many people are working so hard on behalf of all of the people I've talked about, all the stories I mentioned. They're not alone. People in this room who are concerned about these issues are not alone. We make up a good portion of the Canadian population, and I do think that there's hope. Thanks so much.
We've been listening to lawyer Robert Diab, recorded at the Vancouver Public Library on September 19th. Robert Diab is one of the contributors to the book Omer Khadr, O Canada, a new anthology edited by Janice Williamson. The book is published by McGill Queen's University Press.